All right, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Tet Zayin Amud Aleph, six lines down. Gemara is continuing the discussion with regards to the machloka between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, which at the beginning of the Mishnah, the two Amoraim argue about how many malkot you will get. It's based on their interpretation of the psukim with regards to taking Rechaim v'rochev. So Rav Huna suggests that Chaval Rechaim lokesh tayim. If he takes the Rochev, he also is Lokesh Taim. If he takes both of them, he's Lokesh Shalosh. That's the view of Rav Huna. Rav Yehuda, on the other hand, believes that for Rechaim you get one, for Rochev you get one, and Rechaim for Rochev you get two. But there's no separate Malkot for Ki Nefesh Hu Chovel, because that's utilized to tell us about other items of Ochel Nefesh. So now the Gemara brings a Tanya Kovote to Rav Yehuda. We have a Braita that is supportive of Rav Yehuda position, which is Chaval Zug Shel Saparim, Vitzemed Shel Parot. So here he takes as collateral a pair of scissors that were used by a barber, Vitzemed Shel Parot, and the yoke of the Parot, Chayav Shtaim. Then he is Chayav Chu Malkiot for that, Zebatzmo, Vizebatzmo, if he takes them individually, Enu Chayav Elachat. Then he's only Chayav one. So here you have a number of items to discuss. The first of which, what are we speaking about? The girsa that we have in our Gemara, and the girsa that Rashi supports, is that these are scissors that are used by the barber. In their day, the scissors worked that they were two blades that they used to connect, and then they worked as scissors. But they weren't like today, where they were completely fastened together all the time. So each blade was a separate item, and then you combine the blades to do the melacha, which is the cutting or using of the scissors. But like the Rechaim Barochev, there are two component parts to the mechanism. So just like by the mill, you have two stones that work in the mill. So to over here, you have two blades that work with the scissors. And Semed Shel Parot. And over here, you have a pair of oxen. The understanding is that these pair of oxen have a yoke. Rashi suggests that the yoke is made out of two pieces. They're probably the upper and lower piece that connect together. And therefore, you also have this similar type of scenario where you have two pieces that make up the whole of the unit, or the component parts are what make it functional. So why is this Ochel Nefesh? So Rashi says, the Zug Shel Saparim, he does not explain, but by the Parot, he says, Beit Parot Chorshot, that they are plowing. Im Tzmadan, Da'inu Nami, Klei Ochel Nefesh. That is considered to be Klei Ochel Nefesh. So first of all, Rashi has now widened the scope, and we mentioned this by the Mishnah, of what is considered to be a Klei Ochel Nefesh, because over here you see that he's including even animals that are plowing in a field, or a plow itself, because they are used in the production of food, and that's considered to be Klei Ochel Nefesh. So that again expands what we would have thought, Klei Ochel Nefesh. Klei Ochel Nefesh, we would have thought we're in the direct preparation of food, not something so far back in the process. In addition, you see from the Zug Shel Saparim that Klei Ochel Nefesh may not even be things that work with food in particular. It might be the means by which someone makes their parnasa. And that also might be classified as Klei Ochel Nefesh. And you see that from Rashi. The Balei HaTosafot bring from the Rabbeinu Tam that he disagrees. And you can see here he brings from the Ri also that he disagrees. It's based on what the Tosafot says back by the Mishnah, that he changes the girsa based on the Mishnah using the machresha, that was a plow. And Tosfot was bothered by how could it be that there was a plow being taken as collateral in the Mishnah. If a plow is deemed to be Klei Ochel Nefesh, then why is he taking the plow and why is he returning it? It's something that he shouldn't have taken at all, because it's Klei Ochel Nefesh. Therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam gave an alternate version of what the machresha was over there. He was also pushed by the fact that the Gemara's conclusion on that daf was that we're talking about a machresha shel kesef, talking about a silver plow. Whoever heard of a silver plow? Therefore, he says that the meaning of the word machresha is a magreda, which is a comb, bath comb that was used the same way that a lufa is used, which was to exfoliate the dead skin from the body. When they used to go to the bathos, they would use this machresha, which the Gemara in other places calls this comb, a machresha, and that's what it's referring to, because there it's not Ochel Nefesh anymore. But then what does he do with our Gemara? Because our Gemara presents a bigger problem. The scissors here, as well as the plow, seem to indicate that there is such a concept in Ochel Nefesh. So the Rabbeinu Tam has an alternate girsa over here, which is that he says that it's zug shel misparayim, and not zug shel saparim. It's not the scissors of the barber, but rather a pair of scissors, like we would say today, a pair of scissors. And the scissors are scissors that are used to cut the leaves off the vegetables, scissors that are used in the kitchen work, and therefore they are considered to be klei ochel nefesh because they're directly involved with the preparation of the food. Similarly, he says with regards to the parot, that they're not parot that are used for choreshot, that they are plowing, because he doesn't think that the parot should be classified as ochel nefesh. And therefore, he says that the parot over here are meraksot, that they are stomping on the tevuah, that they are dash, they are threshing, they're doing something directly in the preparation process of the food. And that's why they're classified as ochel nefesh. So that's the one issue, which is, what are we speaking about here? Rashi gave us an explanation that widens the scope of what's considered to be klei ochel nefesh. The Rabbeinu Tam, the Balei Tosafot, narrow that scope severely and say there has to be something that is direct hana'ah to the individual, plus that there is some sort of ochel nefesh directly involved, meaning the preparation of food to be used by the individuals. And therefore, the girsa they have is zug shel misparayim, and tzemed shel parot here is a pair of oxen, not for plowing, but rather for threshing or doing something directly to the tevuah. In addition, the Balei Tosafot over here say, kelim shosim ben ochel nefesh. They also here narrow the scope and say, nirad read, dafka kelim. That's only true by utensils. Aval ochlim atzman mutar lachbo. But food itself is not considered to be a problem of ochel nefesh, which is somewhat interesting, because you would think that klei ochel nefesh, which are used in the production and preparation of food, then certainly food itself should have been included. But what the Ri is suggesting, I'm assuming this is his logic, is that if you take away food, then the food is replaceable. If you take away the mechanisms for preparing food, then you've taken away his ability in the future to produce and to prepare for himself the food. So if you just leave with the food and take the kelim away, then he has a limited supply of what he can do or eat, because he only has what he has now. He has no mechanism for preparing in the future. On the other hand, if you take his food and leave him the kelim, then yes, he's missing the current food, but he has now the ability to prepare in the future. And that's what we want to leave him. We want him to leave him the ability to live and continue living in a normal manner. And I'm assuming that's the logic that the Ri has over here, besides the Gzeret HaKatuv, that it's Rechaim VeRochev, which is mentioned in the Torah. But given that, the logic behind it seems to be that we want to leave him the ability to make a parnosa. We want to leave him the ability to be able to prepare his food and to live in an ongoing manner. So that's why he makes that distinction. The next thing is, why is this Braita a proof to Rav Yehuda? Rav Yehuda's position is simply that you have two items that are part of a whole, then you get malkot for those two items, but you don't get malkot for the general term, which is ki nefesh hu chovel. So in the Braita, it says that they get enu chayav ela achat, if he uses each one, and if he uses both of them, he's chayav shtayim. So you could argue that the proof from this Braita is the absence of a statement that there's a third set of malkot. And that's why the Braita is supportive of Rav Yehuda. But then we have another Braita, Vitanya Idach. Here there's a machloket about the girsa of whether it's Vitanya Idach, which is the girsa of Rashi, versus the girsa of the Balei Tosafot, which is Tanya Idach, another Braita. The difference will be whether you need this second Braita to prove like Rav Yehuda, or is this second Braita independent of the first Braita, and each one could have been approved to Rav Yehuda. For Rashi, you need the combination of the Braita to make that work. The Balei Tosafot, each one independently could have proven it, and that's why it's Tanya Idach, which is another Braita, versus Vitanya Idach, where Rashi sees this as being a part and parcel of the proof, which is Chaval zug shel saparim v'tzemed shel parot. Once again, the girsa of the Rabbeinu Tam would be zug shel misparayim v'tzemed shel parot. Yechol lo yeyeh chayav velachat. You would think you only chayav one. Talmud lomar lo yachbol rechayim v'rochev, that you cannot take a rechayim v'rochev. Ma rechayim v'rochev sheheim miyuchadim shnei kelim v'osim lachachat. They are two separate utensils or component parts, but they work towards a single goal, meaning that they are a mill. B'chayav al zeh b'fnei atzmo, v'al zeh b'fnei atzmo. Nevertheless, you're chayav on each one independently. Av kol dvarim, shein shnei kelim, yuchadim. So too, any item where each item is an independent component parts, but they together accomplish a single goal, chayav al ze bifnei atzmo, va ze bifnei atzmo, you're chayav on each one independently. So now, Rashi says over here, you need both brito to make it work, that the brito is supportive of Rabbi Yehuda. Once again, in the second brito, you have the absence of a third malkot, which you would have assumed for Ravuna, you should end up with a third set of malkiot because of the fact that you have ki nefesh hu chovel. Although that's not necessarily so clear, because Rav Huna's statement of Kinefesh Hu Chovel is related to Rechaim Verochev. Because he says that Kinefesh Hu Chovel is going back on Rechaim Verochev to teach you that by Rechaim Verochev you get three, not two. But that might be unique to Rechaim Verochev. It doesn't mean that in other instances he doesn't necessarily agree that you would only get two. Kinefesh Hu Chovel for him is an extra lav that is governing Rechaim Verochev. It's not clear that it governs all situations like this. So from here, these brightot, it's not clear that they're not necessarily supportive of Yehuna because they both say that you get two sets of malkot, but they don't necessarily reference Rechaim Berochev. The second brightot might even be more supportive for him because he says, how do we know about Ochel Nefesh by other issues? Because we extrapolate from Rechaim Berochev to other issues. That seemingly is what the limud is in the second brightot. It even seems more supportive to Rav Huna's position. So Rashi over here explains how the combination of brightot give us this conclusion that Rav Yehuda is correct, or the brightot is supportive of Rav Yehuda, which he says, "Vim tomar matnitan kamaita l'mayayte." Why did you bring the first brightot? Hachanamish meinin leba matraita. Whatever you know from the first brightot, you also know in the second brightot. Ima batraita chayav al zebe atzmo vazeba atzmo kamar. Dozlinan batar malacha ela batar kelim. Says that all the second brayta teaches you is that the way that you define how many malkiot you get is not by the purpose or utility of the item, but rather the number of component parts that are needed to do this work. If standalone component parts that can be joined together to do the work, that's what determines how many malkiot you get. It's the number of kelim, not the utility or the malacha that you're going to do with it. Ulolam. But the truth is, shalosh malkiot, you would get three sets of malkot. Echad mishum rachev, v'chad mishum rechaim, v'chad mishum ki nefesh. Tikaya tarvayu. Ulohochi ashminan kamaita. And that's why he brought the first braita, the Tanya Behejia, because there it says explicitly, chayav shtahim, that you only chayav two. So he says, Rashi, that the second braita could be just teaching you information. The information that it's teaching you is that what do you focus on in determining how many malkiot you get? Do you focus on the malacha, the milling, or do you focus on the mill made of up two millstones? So the bright is teaching you that you focus on the two millstones, not on the mill as a whole. And that's all it could have been teaching you. Therefore, it's not necessarily a proof to Rav Yehuda. But in combination with the first brighta says, you're chayav shnayim. You're chayav two. And there, two means two and not three. But the problem is in the first brayta, we're not talking about Rechaim Verochev. So then how do you know that the two? So Rashi says that's what the first brayta proves. You need the second brayta, which talks about Rechaim Verochev. So between the two of them, you get that by Rechaim Verochev, you get two and exclusively two. That's how Rashi learns that the brayta in combination are supportive of Rabbi Yehuda's position. The Tosafot disagrees fundamentally and says, "V'fi mashapirish b'kuntrish, the kamaita lekelechuchei kashadari." If you can't prove it from the first brayta, then you can't prove it from the second brayta. You could say the same thing, that just like it's coming to teach you about the dinim over there, that you're chayav shnayim, you could say that about the first and second brayta, and it's not coming to teach you about two versus three, it's trying to teach you about two versus one. Is it considered to be one set of malkiot or two sets of malkiot? So he says, I don't understand. He says, the first brayta is totally supportive of Rav Yehuda. To Ravuna, ichayav shtayim. Anytime you're chayav shtayim, akorcha chayav shalosh. By definition, you're chayav three. The kevin de yolif me rechaim verochev, litemayim lav shal rechaim verochev. Ulka chayav shtayim, achav mishum rechaim, achav mishum rochev, imkein chayav nami malkot shlishi. Right. He says differently than what I explained earlier, that ki nefesh u'chovel, the way that Rashi is learning it, is nefesh u'chovel seems to be associated specifically with Rechaim Verochev. What the Baal HaTosafot is saying, no, that Rechaim v'Rachel and then Nefesh Uchovel sets a paradigm by which anytime you have two kelim like this, you're going to get hit for an extra set of malkot, because Nefesh Uchovel always provides an extra set of malkiot. Ve'lo yolif liten b'em lav shel Rechaim el lav shel ki Nefesh Uchovel l'chudei. So he says, well, you want to argue, okay, what are they being chayav for in that braita? Nefesh uchovel. The chayav for nefesh uchovel, you only have one set of malkiot, not two sets of malkiot. So it's clear here that the braita does not acknowledge the lav of nefesh uchovel. And therefore, akeni ralari, the garas tanya idach below vav. Tanya idach is without a vav, because you don't need the second braita to prove anything. It's just another braita that comes to show us this idea of component parts of kelim. Nothing to do with the proof for Rabbi Yehuda, because the first braita would suffice as a proof to the position of Rabbi Yehuda. So again, here you have a machloket as to whether you need both braita to bring the proof or one braita brings the proof, but that would also lead or explains a fundamental machloket between the Balei Tosafot and Rashi as to when does ki nefesh hu chovel apply according to Rabbi Yehuna. And that Rashi says over here, v'lo gassinan tanya idach, says don't have the gears of tanya idach, edera v'tanya idach, from both braitot they bring the proof, and not from one of them. Where would you even get three from? They're not explicit in the pasuk. He says exactly what I mentioned before, which is that the key Nefesh Uchovel references back to the Rechaim V'Rochev in the Pasuk. So when you have Rechaim V'Rochev, you have Nefesh Uchovel. You don't have Rechaim V'Rochev, you don't have Nefesh Uchovel. And therefore, of course, you would get two and not three. And that's why Rashi runs into the problem. So the difference in their view about when does key Nefesh Uchovel apply has implications about how the proof works in these two braitot, whether you need both of them or one braitot would suffice over here. All right, now we move on. How Gavra, the Chovel, Sakina dashkavto mechavre. Person took as collateral, went in and grabbed collateral. He took a knife of the butcher. Now, whether it could be a knife of shchita or it could be a hatchet used to cut up the meat, but either way, it is a kli ochel nefesh, number one. And number two, it is something that's directly used in the preparation of food. So here we have no question about the kli being a kli that is associated with ochel nefesh. There is an alternate girsa, I think, brought in the Aruch that says sakina dash kafta, that it's the knife of the leather workers or leather makers. And then that would work if you hold, like we said before, that the objects that we're speaking about here are not just objects of ochel nefesh, but objects that facilitate the person's ability to make a parnosa. So depending on which view you had there might influence also which girsa you have here in terms of what type of knife it is. After the kameda abaye comes to abaye amalei zilahadre, go give it back to him. Davilei klish osimbo ochel nefesh, because it is a kli that you use towards ochel nefesh, as we discussed. Vita kum bedin ala, and then show up in court to figure out if he owes you any money. So those are that's the statement of abaye. So the two parts of his statement, first of which is return it. The second of which is, you don't have any proof because you're holding this collateral about the fact that there is a loan outstanding. You're taking the collateral was illegal, and therefore it gives you no rights over here. Rav Amar, lo tzarich lemekam bedin ala. You don't have to show up in court to know that there's an outstanding loan. Yechol iton ad kedei demayen. And he has a right to collect up to the value of the collateral that he's holding because of the fact that Rava says the individual can say, if when you come and say, that's my knife, I want it back, you took it as collateral, he could have lied and said, I purchased it. Since I purchased it, it's mine. I didn't take it as collateral. The fact that he agrees or admits that it's collateral, we should believe him because he has amigo. He could have argued and said that it's mine. We have no edim evidencing the fact that he took it as a mashkon. And therefore he has a ability to make a valid claim that it's his because he purchased it. And therefore, when he gives it back and he says it is collateral, he's admitting, and we should believe him, because he had a better claim. And through that migo, he should be believed over here. That migo should govern that the collateral that he has is indication or evidence of the fact that there was a loan outstanding. Though the Gaonim do note here that he will have to take a shvua, because we lose some of the reticence of an individual to lie here in terms of meiz panav, because en adam meiz panav yivnei b'achovo, that's only true when he doesn't have something in hand. But once he has the collateral in hand, there's a possibility that he is Meiz Panav because he already has something that hooks him in, and then we're afraid of his lying. So therefore, we will obligate the Balabayit here to take a Shvuah to support his contention. Ad Kedrei Demehem, whether that's really literally until the value of the item, or Ad Kedrei Demehem means simply until the value of the loan. So if the collateral is less than the value of the loan, you'd still get the full value of the loan. Or if it was in excess of the value of the loan, we let him collect up to the value of the loan, not up to the value of the collateral. Question of how literally you take Ad Kedrei Demehem over here. So now the Gemara says, V'abaye let lehai svaro. Doesn't Rabbi have this svara that Rava is proposing over here, which is that you have a migo that he could say that it was lekuach ubiyadi, that I purchased it. Maishna, why is this different than another case? Mihanu ize, da'achle chushla b'narda. There were these goats that were eating shelled barley in Arda. Va'ata marad chushla, the owner of the shelled barley came v'tafaslo, and he grabbed them. He said he had enough with them, so he took them as collateral to get paid back for all this barley that they've been eating. The katayin tuva. And he goes ahead and he made a claim for it. The same logic that Rava proposed before. He has a right to make a claim up to the value of these goats because he has ability to say, that these are bought by me. And since they are bought by me, they're mine. The fact that he admits that he took them as collateral already makes or gives evidence to the fact that he must have something outstanding over here, and there is something real to his claim. Mar says, "Hatam lamide de avdalo shule ulagure." Who? Over there, these are not items that people lend out or rent out. With regards to goats, either you own the goats or you sell the goats to another party. You don't lend goats to other people. You don't rent out goats to other parties. They're not useful for very much besides their milk, maybe. And even that, it's not normal for people to borrow the goat for its milk or to rent the goat for its milk. So if that's the case, then either you own them or you don't own them. So in that case, if it's in his possession, there's good evidence of the fact that it's actually his. And so when he comes and says, I took it as collateral, we're going to believe him because of the fact he has it in his possession and didn't make the argument that I purchased them. Because purchasing them would have been a valid claim. Over here, by the case of the knife, this is something that people lend out. You lend your knife to your neighbor, you rent out your knife to your neighbor to use, and therefore his claim is not a valid claim. Because when he says, that's not necessarily true, because he could be renting them, he could have borrowed them. It's not clear evidence by the fact that he says it's collateral, that his alternative was to say that it was purchased. Because even if he said it was purchased, we wouldn't necessarily believe him. Because he could have rented it, he could have borrowed it. The Shalach Ravuna Ba'avim, Dvarim Asuim Lash'il Laskir, items that are normally lent out or rented out, Ve'amar Lukuchim Hein Biyodi, and he makes a claim that they were purchased, I own them, Einu Ne'aman, he's not believed. You don't get an automatic Migo being believed in those cases. Just because they're in your possession is not a Chazaka over here. A Chazaka works when they're being in your possession is evidence of something. That's true when these are items that are not lent out or rented out. Then when it's in your possession, that's a good chazaka to say that you should be believed that you purchased it. But in cases where people normally rent out or lend out these items, just because it's in your possession is not evidence of anything. You could be renting it, you could be borrowing it, you could have purchased it, but there's no evidence to each one, and therefore it's not a good claim. So that's what Abaye says. Abaye says, the migo works by the goats, the migo does not work by the knife. The migo works by the goats, because people don't rent and lend out goats. Therefore, when it's in your possession, you have a migo. You could have said, lekuachu biyadi, I purchased them and they're mine. So when you go ahead and say they're collateral, you should be believed because you could have kept the goats. The fact that you say they're collateral gives you a nemanut through that migo. On the other hand, by the case of the knife, over there, you don't have nemanut. If you say it was purchased by me, just because it's in your possession, it's not enough evidence because we wouldn't believe you. Even if you said the kuach ubiyadi, we'd give it back to the other party because you could have been borrowing it. You could have been renting it. So since you don't have a migo, then you're not believed by the collateral as well. And that's why Abaye says you got to come to din to determine whether there is an outstanding loan or an outstanding obligation here. Because just because it's in your possession gives you evidence of nothing because you're not believed. Even if you told us it was purchased, you wouldn't be believed. Therefore, you lose your migo. You lose your migo, then you're also not believed that it is collateral over here. Well, Abaye has a very strong position now. And therefore, you have a problem, which is, Varova, lately, high svara. Wait a minute, doesn't Rava subscribe to this? what Abai is saying, it makes a lot of sense. So why isn't Rava also following that position of Abai? V'harava, ofek zuga de sarvala, v'sifra de gadato, miyatme. He took away from Yitomim these two items. One was a pair of scissors that is used to shear the wool, whether it's to shear wool off of the actual animal, or whether it's to shear the wool when it's made into a woolen coat to cut it down to size afterwards. The Sifra de Agadato, and some book of learning. It's called it a Sefer of Agadah. It's a Midrash, a Sefer of Midrashim, that was not used on a regular basis, but used from time to time. He took those away, biyatmei, from the Yatmei, b'dvarim asurim lashil askir, in a case where these are items that are normally lent out or rented out. So since these are normally rented out or lent out, the individual comes with a claim that he lent them to the father of the Yitomim. So if he lent them to the father of the Yitomim can't make a claim of lakuachem b'yadenu, that we purchased them, or my father purchased them. Can't say that because there's no evidence of the fact that he purchased them. Without evidence, we're not going to believe you because these are items that do get lent out and do get rented out, and being in your possession is not a chazuk in that case. So Rava does subscribe to that logic. If he subscribed to that logic, why doesn't he come to the same conclusion that Abaye came to? Amalcha Rava, this has implications in Halacha and other places as well, which is, Hainami kevin de domi or dahanami gamo kapte inche velo moshle. Since these are items that can become damaged, people are makpid on them and they won't lend them out. Here we're talking about a shchita knife. Talking about a hatchet that's used by the butcher, his specific hatchet. These are items that have a particular use, and they are a special use, that you don't use them for other reasons or other items, and therefore, people don't lend them out because of their uniqueness. This says nafkaminon in Shabbat as well. When it comes to Shabbat, you have kli that is muksa machmat chisaron kis, that there's a kli that is muksa because it's only used for that particular purpose and no other purpose, like the knife of Amila, the knife of Shchita. You wouldn't use your Shchita knife to cut your vegetables. You wouldn't use your Mila knife to cut your vegetables. Meaning that those are knives that are unique for the particular purpose that they are designated. That becomes Muksma Machmad Chisyonun Kis because their primary use and unique use is something that's Asur on Shabbat. So unlike cases where if you would take a hammer and you want to use the hammer to break open nuts on Shabbat, there we would let you do that, because it's a kli shemalach tol isur. Normally it's used for isur, but over here you have a heter purpose for it, and you would use your hammer for the purpose of breaking your nuts. But in the case of a shchita knife and a mila knife, that wouldn't be the case. There are hammers that are unique enough that you wouldn't use them to break nuts. So again, you have to look at each kli. But that's what Rava suggests over here, that these were unique enough items, or special enough items, that people would not lend them out. That means that if you're in possession of it, that's already a chazaka or evidence of the fact that you either bought it or you're holding it as collateral, and therefore you get a migo that you're neman over here. So Rava says, that's why I say over here that the possession of the knife gives him a nemanut that says that if he says it's collateral and not that it was purchased, he's believed, and therefore we can collect the loan against the value of the collateral that's over here. What comes out of this, interesting enough, is that Abaye says over here, Zilahadre, give it back to him. Now, Abaye, by saying that, makes this lav seemingly different than what we saw with Kovesh Sachar Sachir. Remember, by Kovesh Sachar Sachir, we talked about that being a discrete lav, that you violated a particular time or a particular moment, and after that, it's not a persistent lav. What you see from Abaye's requirement to return the object that he took illegally, here he took collateral that was Ochel Nefesh, the fact that after he violated and took it, that we require him to return it, seems to show that there's a persistent violation of the lav. So from Abaye, it would sound like this is a persistent lav, and the only way to get yourself out of the problem is to return it. Because if it was a discrete lav, then why do you need to return it? The answer to that could be that it's a lav hanitak b'aseh, which is that it's a lav that can be rectified by an aseh, and the aseh is hashev tashiv, to return it. Now, that is a little harder because the Gemara in Makot, when it talks about ilav and itak the assay, does say that taking of collateral when you go into the house, take the collateral, there is ilav and itak the assay. There is a question whether you can extrapolate that to the other isurim that are associated with the chabalah, with the taking of collateral. That's because the way the psukim are structured, it says, lo yachbol rechaim v'rochev ki nefesh uchovel. That's a single lav. Then it goes on, there's another lav, which is don't enter his house to take something. Then b'chutz tamod, then hashev tashiv lo et avot. So you could argue that hashev tashiv lo is directed at the lav of lo tavo beito lavo tavoto. And that is a lav in itak de'asei solely. The other lavim of Beged Almanah, as well as Rechaim Verochev, may not be a lav in itak de'asei because of that. And therefore, you would have to argue that the reason Abaye is suggesting he return it is because of the problem that it's a persistent lav rather than a lav in itak de'asei. Because it's in all likelihood, it may not be a lav in itak de'asei. Because in order to be a lav in itak de'asei, according to many Rishonim, you have to have an explicit assay that is directly associated with the lav. Can't be that there's some amorphous type of assay that could rectify it, or that there's some assay in the parshia. It has to be a direct connection to the lav. And in this case, you don't have that necessarily, and therefore it would not be a lav in itak de'asei, but rather it would be a persistent lav that can only be rectified by returning it, and that's why Abaye insists on him returning it in this case. Tosfot also here mentions from the Gemara in Shavuot, that the Gemara there in Shavuot has other qualifications for when something is classified or considered to be an item that is lent out. Meaning that, is this a person who normally lends out things or rents things out? Is this a person who normally sells his wares or his kevim? So all of these are factors in the matter, meaning that if this is a person who never sells his particular objects, then if he comes and makes a claim of lakuach ubiyadi, that's not a really strong claim, because this is not a person that normally sells his items. So there are other factors that could come into the consideration here as to whether he is believed because of the nature of the person that we are speaking about. So Tosfot tries to reconcile between our Gemara, which has a single qualification, which is this an object that is rented out or not? Versus the Gemara in Shavuot, which has other qualifications, including the person and other items that direct us as to whether you can believe the individual in those cases. The Rambam gives a narrower definition of items that are usually rented out, which is that these are items by their nature or size. People don't buy them for their exclusive usage, but buy them with the intent of renting them out. So he gives an example of a yoreg gedola, talking about a large cauldron. Now, the large cauldron is so expensive that somebody wouldn't necessarily buy it for themselves. They buy it for themselves, but with the intent of renting it out to others, because that's how he pays for it. And that's what it means here, kelim that normally are rented out. It is that the nature, the character of the kli itself makes it that people would rent it out, not simply whether this is a kli that is rented out. All right, with that, we finish the ninth perek, Hadron Alach HaMikabel. And with this, we begin the final perek of Baba Metzia, which is also known as the introduction to Baba Batra. The reason it's introduction to Baba Batra is because it deals with shutafim, with partners, and the division of property, which is the first Mishnah in Baba Batra. First Mishnah in Baba Batra deals with a wall between parties. When the wall falls down, how do they split it, or the obligation to build the wall on those parties. So here we get a little bit of a preview of that in the last parak of Baba Metzia, similar to what happened in Baba Kama, where the last parak of Baba Kama, or the last two parakim in Baba Kama, led us into Baba Metzia. It really changed the tone of the Masechta to be much more similar to the next Masechta. And again, it's not far-fetched, even if you say that all the Bavot are considered separate Masechtot, but we know that there is definitely an opinion that all the Bavot were actually a single Masechta, Masechet Nezikin. If that's the case, it would make a lot of sense that these transitions are happening in the Prokim at the end of Baba Metzia, as well as at the end of the Prokim of Baba Kamo. So here the Mishnah says, Habayit va'aliyah shel shnayim. You have a house, and the upper part of the house, it's basically a duplex that is shared by partners. They could have come into the partnership because they were brothers that inherited their father. They inherited the house, and they split the house as a duplex. One would have the upstairs, one would have the downstairs. Or it could be that they're partners because they built the house together, and they were partners in the duplex. Shinaflu. And then it fell down. The house in the attic, we'll use attic loosely here. Aliyah just means the upper house. We'll say attic, even though it means the upper house. So now, here, if the house collapses, they're both now coming to divide the spoils of the house, which is the wood and the stones that were there to rebuild. To whom do the stones and the wood belong to, or the bricks that are there? How do we divide them up? So now, the Gemara says, Shneim chokim beitzim uvavanim ubafar. They divide evenly the materials that are the building blocks of the house. They split those materials evenly. Varim, Elu Avanim Asiyot Ishtaber. And we look and see which stones would have broken. If one of them recognizes that they belong to him, he takes them and they count towards his half. The Mishnah has three different statements, and the three different statements seem to be somewhat contradictory. Because the first statement says, just split it. The second statement says, well, we look at how it happened. What happened over here? The way Rashi says it is, we look at the way that it fell, which is that you have two ways that a building can collapse. A building can collapse on itself, or a building can collapse because it topples over. Normally, or in most cases, when you have very tall buildings, they topple over. Right? What was unusual in the collapse of the World Trade Center was that it collapsed on itself because of the design of the building, so that it collapsed on itself. The difference would be, according to Rashi, which stones would have been broken or which stones would have been further away. Right. If it collapses on itself, it's more likely that the lower stones are broken because the pressure and the weight coming down would have crushed the bottom stones rather than the upper stones. In the case where it topples over, then it's more likely that the upper stones are broken because of the fact that they fell further and there's more pressure and weight on them from the fall. That's one. The other thing is, where the stones are found would also make a difference. If it toppled over, the stones that are further away most likely belong to the upper parts of the building. The ones that are closer belong to the lower parts. If it collapses on itself, again, the upper part of the pile should be the upper part of the building. The lower part of the pile should be the lower part of the building. That's how Rashi learns it. Other Rishonim, including the Ramban, say that the idea here is not about how it fell, but rather the size of the two. Which is sometimes the house and the aliyah, one is bigger than the other. The lower house is bigger than the aliyah. So then the split should be defined by the size of the house and the aliyah, rather than simply splitting it in half. Others argue, no, it's split in half. Just because one is bigger than the other doesn't mean there was more materials in one than the other. I mean that you could have it that the house is smaller than the aliyah, but the house being the foundation for the aliyah requires more materials in order to support the upper area. Again, on the upper area, since it has the roof, as well as a normal roof, it has to have the waterproofing roof. So over there, maybe also there are extra materials on the aliyah versus the lower part of the house. So for that reason, maybe it's not correct. But the Ramban and many other Rishonim argue that size should make a difference, and that's what the Mishnah is after, which is, V'ro'im Eloi Avanim Asim Lishtaber. Which is the last statement of the Mishnah. If one of them recognizes their stones or things that were in their house, for instance, we know that they use their walls for storing things in. So they might recognize a stone that has a certain hole in it, or has a certain space in it that they utilized in their house. And so it's familiar to them. So they can make a claim on that stone. And now when they're splitting it, you have to give something on the other side to the other party. So what is it that you give them in return? That we'll discuss in the Gemara. But again, you have three sections to the Mishnah that have different ways of dividing. We have to understand when each is used. Midiktani ro'in, because we see over here ro'in, we see, which seems to indicate, michlal, te'ika l'meka malayu, that you have an ability to be discerning over here, ibechavsa nofil, ibechavota nofil. Did it fall by collapsing on itself? Or did it fall by toppling over? I mean, the fact that ro'in means that we look at the evidence, and through the evidence we can make a determination, iochi, if that's the case, reisha maichukim. Why are we splitting it evenly in the reisha? Nechzei ibechabota nafil, aliyoto idvar. If it toppled over, then the aliyah is the one that's going to have all the broken stuff because it fell further. Ibechavsa nafil, if it collapsed on itself, tataita idvar. Then the lower house is the one that got crushed or the one that has the broken stones or bricks to it. So it should be obvious from the evidence to whom each part belongs. Then why are we splitting it evenly over here? It says, though, tzvicha nafel belelia, fell at night. At night, unlike today, you can't bring in lights to see things. If there's no way to bring in artificial lighting, even candles aren't sufficient. Why not just wait till the morning and take a look? Just like there's not enough light to look at the evidence at night, there's also not enough light to clear up the evidence at night, and therefore just wait till the morning and we can look at it. To paninu, people already came and helped themselves to whatever was there. The left say, man paninu. Let's find out the people who came and cleared it up. The leshelo, we'll ask them, what happened? Where was it? How did you find the thing scattered? What did you pick up? Dipaninu b'nei reshut harabim. It was public domain, came and cleared it up. Or it fell into the public domain, and therefore they were cleaning it up. Not because they were stealing, they said that they were clearing out the reshut harabim, so that it was passable at that point in time. So now we have no evidence anymore. V'azul ba'amo, now they're gone, and we have no idea who took it or what they saw, what evidence was there. It doesn't necessarily mean they took it. They could have just piled it up back into their property. They could have done something that ruins this state of the evidence, and it was done at night, and therefore nobody knows what the actual evidence or what it looked like. So Gemara says, V'lechse b'shut man yotvan. Why don't we look at in whose property it fell? V'lavi idach ha'motzi mi'chavero alav ha'raya. So here, if you have the building, if it fell into one or the other's property, then property is a chazakah. And if that's a chazakah, we know that whenever you have the chazakah, the other person is a motzi mechavero, alav araya. Lo tzricha, it's a case, diyatvan b'chatzer detarvayu. It was in a joint property, meaning that they both own the chatzer. Since that's the case, there's nobody has a greater chazakah than the other one. Inami b'reshut harabim. It fell into reshut harabim, where neither of them has chazakah. B'ibaitema, Shutafin b'chiyat gavna lo kapte ahadodi. That shutafim in this case are not machpid on each other. Even if it is the other partner's property, the other partner will not be machpid when they are as shared partners put some of their items in the other party's property. If you are partners and say the chatzer, this is a duplex, and the chatzer is split in half. So you have one half of the chatzer, the other one has the other half of the chatzer. So, certain times when you place a little bit of your stuff in his chatzer, a little bit of his stuff in your chatzer, you're not so makbid because you're already partners, you already have a joint ownership anyway. Now, the Balei Tosafot and Baba Batra will come and qualify this statement. And they will say that's only true when it's there for a short duration. People are not makbid when things are there for a short amount of time. If you leave it there for a very long time, even shutafim will be makbid. And if the shutaf was not makpid, that's evidence of the fact that it's not a chazakah for him, or it's not any proof to him, by the mere fact that he didn't come either and clear it out, or he didn't demand that the other person clear it out. The fact that he doesn't do that ruins the fact that they are shutafim. So what the Gemara is speaking about over here, according to the Balei Tosafot and Baba Batra, is in the short duration, they're not makpid on each other. Therefore, it's not evidence of a chazakah. If it stood there for 3 years or 4 years, they left it in their chatzer, then already that would be evidence of something because people don't allow others to utilize their chatzer for that duration, even if they are partners. From all these different answers, we end up in the ratio of a Mishnah in a case where it's inconclusive. The evidence is inconclusive because of the fact that it was cleaned up already, it happened at night. We don't have the parts left where they fell, so we can't look at the evidence. And we don't have a chazakah here because of the way that it fell. It either fell into areas that are jointly owned, neither of them owns, or even if they do own a part of the property, they are shutafin, and they're not makbid on each other, so there's no evidence from placement. So the ratio of the Mishnah is when there's no evidence from the actual spill, collapse, we're missing that evidence. We're also missing the chazak or the evidence of ownership because it's in that property. So now you're left in a safek. So chokim, the best thing to do over here is to split the materials between them. So that's what the ratio of the Mishnah is speaking about. The next line in the Mishnah that says, Roim elu avanim asiyut ishtaber, that's in a case where we do have the evidence available to us. If the evidence available to us, then we will make a determination based on the evidence as to whom the stones or wood belong to. So the first part of the Mishnah is where we don't have any of this information. The second line of the Mishnah is in a case where we do have the evidence. And then we'll let the evidence dictate as to whether we give it to the Baal Aliyah or the Baal HaBayit. Now we move on to the third section, which is, if he makes a claim for a particular stone or particular bricks and say, those are mine, then what is the counterparty saying? What does the other party say? If he says, you're right, yes, pshita, then what's the question? Of course he gets to keep it. Why would you think otherwise if they're both agreeing that it belongs to one of the two parties? If he doesn't agree, lama dotel. Why does he get to take it? Meaning that if he doesn't agree with the other party, why does your claim that it's yours give you the right to take it when the other party doesn't necessarily agree? It's one thing if he acquiesces. Okay, fine, you can take it then. But if he doesn't acquiesce, why should you be able to take it just because you're making a claim? It says, Ella, damale, ini yodeya. He said back, I don't know. It's not a case where he says yes or no. It's a case where he says, I just don't know. Lema, Davi, Tiyufta, the Rav Nachman. Let us say this is a strong refutation in the position of Rav Nachman. Remember, we had Rav Nachman earlier in the Masechta, back on Daf Tzadi Zayin, Amud Bet, that Rav Nachman over there, we had a machloket about Bari Vishema in the Mishnah. When you make a Bari claim, and the other party makes a Shema claim, Bari Vishema, do we say Bari Adif, which is the position of those that oppose Rav Nachman? Rav Nachman himself says that Bari Vishema, Bari does not dictate in that case. So he had a problem in the Mishnah because of that, and now he has a problem here again because of that, which is Ditmar. Mane libi adecha, Fala Omer, any Yodea. Person comes with a definitive claim and says, you owe me 100 zuz. The other party says, they don't know. Ravon of Rav Yehuda, who argue on Rav Nachman, Amrei Chayav, Bari Vishema, Bari Adif. And therefore, the person who makes the definitive claim gets to take it here, and he'll get the claim of the 100. Rav Nachman, Rav Yochanan, Amrei Patur. You say you're Patur, Bari Vishema, we don't say Bari Adif. So now we had a problem in the Mishnah back on Tzadi Zayin, now we have a problem here as well. Kedam Rav Nachman, Kagon, Sheis, Esek, Shwabinem. How did Rav Nachman solve the problem in the Mishnah earlier in the Masechta? He says that there was another Shvuah already that became engaged over here. There was a Shvuah deoraita that already was a part and parcel of what was going on. And then you have this Bari Vishema on top of it. That's what generates the Chiyuv. And that's because, Ochanami. So it's over here, Kagon Sheis, Esek, Shvuah Bineem. Hei Chidami, Esek, Shvuah Bineem. What is exactly the case of Esek Shvanayim? Kedarova. Damarova, mana lebi adecha. The person who makes a definitive claim, you owe me 100 zuz. Falomer, in the chabiyadi, ila chamishim. Says, no, I owe you 50. That is what we call moda bemitzad. Moda bemitzad demands a shvuah. Vashar, in yodeya. And about the remaining 50, I have no clue. Now he has a problem, because moda bemitzad demands a shvuah deoraita. Now you have a shvuah deoraita. What is the shvuah that you're taking? The shvuah that he's taking is that I owe you 50, which we don't really need because he's admitting to it, but the shvuah is about the kfirah, the denial of the other 50. Over here, he can't take a shvuah denying the other 50 because it's eni yodeya. He doesn't know about the other 50. Mitoch sheni yocholi shava yishalem. Since he's unable to take the shvuah, he pays. He has an obligation to take a shvuah moda b'miksad. He can't take the shvuah because of the nature of his claim, and therefore, since his claim causes him to be unable to take the shvuah, he's obligated, he has to pay therefore. And that's why the Bari and Shema work over here. So you have to pay 100 then, because the Bari and Shema dictates, not because of Bari B'Shema, but rather because his inability to take the shvuah, moda b'miksat over here, his inability to take the shvuah, which would make him patur, makes him chayav. And therefore the 50 admitted, of course he has to pay, but the other 50 now he has to pay because he can't take a shvuah to make himself patur. Now, the Baal Yetos vote raised an issue over here, which is that even Rav Nachman himself agrees that the only time we invoke this principle is where the individual should have known. He should have known the information, and he said Eni Odeya. The Eni Odeya is a problematic claim because he should have known the information. So back on the Mishnayot, back on Tzadi Zayin, we discussed that versus the case of the parah that was pregnant in Baba Kama, as to the nature of the difference of those cases, whether it's something that he should have known, or is any Odeya a fair claim because he couldn't have known the information and nobody really knows the information. So there we said that the Bari claim is not as strong a Bari claim because it's not really clear that he should know the information. And the any Odeya is not a bad claim because there's no way he should have known the information. In the case where he should have known the information and one makes a Bari claim, that makes it a strong Bari claim. And when one says any Odeya, that's a weak claim because he should have known the information. Over here, how is he supposed to know? Any Odeya is not a weak claim over here. He doesn't know which are his stones. He doesn't know which stones belong to the other guy, belong to him. Then any Odeya is not a weak claim. And therefore, just because he can't take a shvuah may not make him chayav over here, because even Rav Nachman agrees that he didn't have to have this information. So the Ran notes that in this case he should have known that when people live in a house, they are familiar with the particular stones, bricks. Again, we're talking about a case where these are not uniform. They're not mechanically or machine made. Each one was a unique stone or cut because of the fact that it was done by hand. That when a person lives in a house and he sees the stones and the bricks on his wall, he should have some sense. And therefore, the Eni Odeya is a weak claim over here because we do expect him to know. Not know everything, but at least have some semblance of recognition of what was the materials or the stones or bricks that were in his house, and therefore the Eni Odeya over here is a weak claim. So that's why over here, the claim of Bar Yishema works according to Rav Nachman, not because of Bar Yishema, but simply because of Bar Yishema be'esek shvua, and that's what generates the chiyuv. Valoj ben achishbon, as we said in the Mishnah, that if he makes a claim for certain whole bricks and says those are mine, we give the other party an equivalent number of bricks to offset the split. So now, what is that? Sover Rava the Meimar. Rava thought to say, lefi cheshbon shvurot. We give him broken bricks back. This guy's taking whole bricks and says, these bricks are mine, these whole ones are mine. So when we give the other party his 50%, do we give him 50% of broken bricks to offset the whole bricks that this one's taking? That's what Rava thinks. Alma, gaven damar, eni yodea, rea tfei. Because he says eni yodea, he has the lower hand over here, and he gets the worst of the two bricks. Wait a minute, the claimant here has the lower hand. Because the fact that he knows these particular bricks and doesn't know the remainder of the bricks, too late, then he shouldn't get any more. And then all the other full bricks belong to the other party. So the question is, when we don't know, whose don't know is problematic? So Rava thought to say that the don't know of the counterparty was the problem. The one knows his bricks, the other one doesn't know his bricks. If he doesn't know his bricks, then we're going to give him the broken ones and assume you get the broken ones because you have the lower hand over here. But he says that's not a good logic, because since the other party knows about these whole bricks, and the fact that he doesn't know about the other ones, that makes him the worst claim over here, because he's a guy who knows. And since he doesn't know about the rest, that actually lowers his claim to the remainder. And we should give the whole bricks to the other party to offset the whole bricks that he is taking. So you go by the cheshbon shleimot. You give him offsetting whole bricks to the ones that he claims that are his. So this guy comes along and says, these 10 bricks are definitely from my part of the house. I'm taking them and they're all whole. Then we have another 10 whole bricks that nobody knows. We're going to give those to the other party to even it out. So then what's the point of identifying your bricks? If you're identifying your bricks, the other guy's going to get the others. So Iochi Maika Mahanile. What's it helping him here? Lemilbana Ravcha Inamatina Dma'abdo. Says that it helps him, like we said before, not all bricks are created equal. And that is that either some bricks are squarer rather than a rectangle. Normally bricks are longer than they are wide. There are some bricks that are square. Square bricks are more valuable than the rectangular bricks because they can support more weight. They are better as foundation bricks or better to use to put other things on top of them. So that'll be the difference. If he recognizes whole square bricks, we may not give him whole square bricks in return to the other party. We'll give him whole rectangular bricks. That's one. And the other thing is how good a formation the bricks are. Remember, the bricks are being made by mixing the plaster and the cement to make the bricks. Though, depending on how good the gibul is, how good the mix is, you have stronger bricks or better quality bricks. So quality could be a difference. Even though you're giving whole bricks, there may be whole bricks that are better quality or lower quality. So even though they're splitting the whole bricks, nevertheless, he knows the ones that are his, and those are better quality bricks. So there are value in terms of making a claim, which is that your claim could get you better bricks, whether it's quality-wise, shape-wise, or other features, even though we're giving the other party also whole bricks. The fact that Rava says Savar, Rava the Meimar, we know that whenever the Gemara uses the term Savar, that means he thought to say, it means the Gemara will reject that in the end and take up the other opinion. And that's why the Locha here is like a Abaye versus Rava, because it's not a Machloket Rava and Abaye. Rava thought to say, but in the end, he agrees to Abaye's position, and that's the way we paskin. Alright, next Mishnah. Abayit v'aliyah. The way Rashi has the Girsa here, that's it. Abayit v'aliyah, and we're going to see clearly in the Gemara, we're talking about here a socher and maskir. We're talking about a renter and a landlord. A landlord owns the duplex, he lives downstairs, and he rents the upper part, the upper half of the house, to another party. That is the scenario that the Gemara is going to say. Nevertheless, the Baliyat Tosafot here bring from the Rabbeinu Tam that he thought the Girsa should be Abayit v'aliyah shel shnayim, that the word shnayim could be put in here. And even though the Gemara talks about a socher maskir, there might be relevance even for two parties, shnayim, where it's two owners, not when it's a maskir and a socher. We'll go with Rashi's interpretation that we're talking about a renter and a landlord. So nifchata aliyah, the upper floor breaks down. So the floor, which is really the ceiling of the lower half and the floor of the upper half, breaks down. So the party cannot live in the upper part of the house because he's missing a floor there now. Veina balabait would say the takein. And the balabait has no, the landlord has no interest in fixing that, his ceiling or the floor of the upper part. Hari balaliyah yored. The Baal Aliyah, the one who is upstairs, can go downstairs, Bidar Lamato, and he can live downstairs, Achi Takein Lovet Aliyah, till the landlord fixes the upper part, he can live downstairs. Rav Yossi Omer, Atachton Utenet Atikra, Belyon Et Amaziva. When you go to fix the levels between, then who has to contribute what part of that is there? So it's the bottom party, the one who's downstairs, gives the ceiling, or in other words, the beams and the wood that create the floor, and the upper one puts the maziva, which is the plastering to flatten out and to smooth and waterproof the floor. He does that. He provides that plaster or that maziva to go on top of that which is placed there. All right, so now, the Baal Tosafot bring evidence to Rashi's pshat over here because of the split of the floor and the ceiling between them. Because Tosafot makes a point over here. He says, Ubi Gemara Mukila B'Socher Maskir. The Gemara sets up this case as being a renter and a landlord. Mishum, the Bachim Shechulku, if you're talking about brothers who split it, partners who split it, Ein Ala Tachton Livnot HaTikra. And the lower party has no obligation to build the floor for the upper party. The reason being is because the guy who lives downstairs, he can say, I don't need a ceiling because he has the upper roof that protects him from the elements. And therefore he can say, I'm just as happy to live without a ceiling here. So therefore it becomes the obligation of the upper owner of the duplex, not only to put in the maziva, but to put in the tikra, because the lower party has no use for the tikra. And since he has no use for the tikra, therefore it becomes the obligation of the upper party solely. And that's why Tosfot says that Rashi is likely right here because of this issue of the socher umaskir. So that's the way that the Rabbi Yossi learns over here. Tosfot sees that as evidence of the fact that we're talking about a socher umaskir and not partners who split it. But as you can see in the Od Aleph of the Gra, he says, Nirbeinai v'chein kotav arosh. The Rosh is supportive of this view of the Baal Tosfot. But on the other hand, the Poskei Safarad, the Rif, and the Rambam, Katov, to be chukul. If it's a case of partners, Modi Rabbanan, the Rabbi Yossi. The Rabbanan even agree to Rabbi Yossi. Over here, they're arguing, but it's a case of Socher Maskir. That's why they're arguing. But in a case of two partners, they definitely have to both contribute because it's something that sits between them. So the Rif and the Rambam come to the exact opposite conclusion of the Baal Tosafot. Baal Tosafot say partners, it's all on the bottom guy to do it. The Rif and the Rambam say even the Rabbanan agree when it's partners that both have to join in to do it. The only question here is because it's a socher maskir, it's a landlord-renter relationship, so the Rabbanan think it's all on the landlord to fix. Whereas Rabbi Yossi says it's still the joint efforts of the two parties. Because you could argue that the wear and tear on the maziva came from the person who lived upstairs, and that's why he's responsible for it. But in a case of a landlord-renter situation, when it comes to the infrastructure of the house and normal wear and tear, that is the responsibility of the Baal Habayit. And that's why the Rabbanan over here would think that the socher, the renter, has no obligation vis-a-vis the maziva. Whereas in case of partners, he would have an obligation to put in the maziva because he's the one who wears down that part of the house or that shared aspect of the ceiling and floor from the below to above. So it's interesting. They come to the opposite conclusion of the Baal Tosafot. Nifchata bekamo. How much does the ceiling floor have to collapse in order to make it unlivable upstairs? Rav Amar Beruba, you have to lose the majority of the floor space upstairs. Shmuel Amar Ba'arba'a. As soon as you have four tfachim, because it's in Zachar, so Zachar would be Arba tfachim, if it was Amot, it would be Arba Amot. So Arba means four tfachim. If you already lose four tfachim worth of space, floor space upstairs, it's not considered livable anymore. Rav Amar Beruba, Rav says it has to be the Rove. Aval ba'arba lo, but a smaller amount is not. Adam dar chetzio lamato v'chetzio lamalo. People live with half of their possessions upstairs and half of their possessions downstairs. We're all familiar with that. Most houses today are two-level houses. We have half our possessions upstairs, half our possessions downstairs. So Rav says you can manage it. Even though he's living upstairs, he can place in the areas where the ceiling floor have collapsed, he can put his things downstairs, and he'll go downstairs when he needs it. He'll go downstairs and get his stuff from downstairs and bring it back upstairs. Shmuel Amar ba'arba, in Adam dar chetzio lamata v'chetzio lamalo. Shmuel says people don't live that way. They live on one floor. He doesn't have to go downstairs every time he needs something from downstairs. He wants to have all his things up on where he's living. By definition, he'll have access to downstairs. Because the fact that the Baal Bayit is not closing it means that the Baal Bayit doesn't care about that privacy. And therefore, it's now open to him. If it's open to him, then instead of placing it on the floor upstairs, he's going to place it on the floor downstairs. That's what Rav suggests. Hey, Chidami. So this is your question, Yechiel. Idamar aliyah zo. If he rented him this aliyah, asdo, bad luck. If it collapses and it's gone, you don't get it anymore. I mean, that if he particularly rented out to you this space and defined it as zoo, again, when we say zoo or zed means exactly this, pointing to this item, then you get exactly that. And once it disappears, the Baal Bayit has no obligation towards the renter. The renter got it. Truth is, the renter will only have to pay for the time that he was there. But after that, the Baal Bayit has no obligation to him. Eladamar aliyastam. He said that I'm going to rent you an upper chamber. But if that's the case, loger le'achrine. He should have to rent him out somewhere else. He's got to replace it. Okay, fine. He doesn't want to fix his place. But then he's got to rent him another location where he can live in an aliyah. Amarova, lo tzricha. No, the case is here. Damale, aliyah zu, shani maskir lecha, kisalka solik ba'ada, kinochit chavat ba'ada. While it's standing, you'll be in it. When it collapses, you'll come down. So Gemara says, Yochi, Maila Memra. What's the Kiddush then? Of course, if that's the terms of the agreement that says, while there's an aliyah, you live upstairs. When there's no aliyah, you come live downstairs. Then what's the Mishnah telling you? You don't need a Mishnah to tell you that those are the contractual terms that you have to abide by the contractual terms. This is the Kiddush. This aliyah that is above this house, I am renting to you. Because we don't view it as being simply an identification of location. Because he's already saying ze or zu. Ze or zu means that he's either present or pointing to it. They know exactly what they're speaking about. Why did he say it's the aliyah on top of this house? What is that extra information doing? The extra information is telling you that he's mishabed. He's encumbering the lower part of the house to the upper part of the house. And that's what the chiddush of the Mishnah is. That Chid Amar, that when you tell him you're renting the upper chamber that's on top of this house or on top of this area, then you're telling him as long as it's upstairs, you'll stay upstairs. If it's not upstairs, now I'm mishabed. I'm giving you rights to come and occupy the lower house. We have a similar idea. It's not exactly alike, but a similar idea that when you use an object that is not integral to the other item as an identification, then that encumbers it to the other item. Person says to him, the grapevine that is stretched across, Rashi calls it a farsaik. It's not clear if Rashi means a farsaik in the modern terminology, which would be a peach, or a farsaik in the Gemara, which is a persimmon, or some other fruit that they use to create perfumes. So whatever it is, there's a tree there that the grapevines rest on. So instead of having to put up trellis work to hold up the grapevines, they're stretching them across the tree. V'nekar ha-parsik. And the tree was uprooted. Bama said lifnei Rabbi Chiya. The incident came before Rabbi Chiya to adjudicate. V'mar chayav atalamido pirsak kozman she'adalit kaima. As long as the grapevine's alive, you have to provide him the tree upon which it rests. Because when he stated it, he said, dalit she'agabi pirsak. He specifically stated the grapevine that's on this tree. So by saying on this tree, which is not necessary information, he's saying that the tree is mishubad to the grapevine. Now in this case, it's slightly different because when the grapevine dies, he's no longer entitled to the tree. But in essence, the tone and the idea is the same, which is that when you give extraneous information that tells you not about location, not exactly where it is, but information that is saying that the other item is somehow encumbered to the particular item that you are purchasing, then that's encumbered. And that's the case here when he says the aliyah that's on top of this bayit. And same thing over here when he says it's a grapevine leaning on this tree. Bayit Rabbi Abba bar Mamel. Shudar, when he goes downstairs, so now the aliyah collapsed, the landlord refuses to build it, he's encumbered to allow him to live downstairs. How does the person who lived upstairs live downstairs? Livadohu dar, kidmi ikara. Does he get exclusive rights to downstairs and he kicks the landlord out? Says, you're out of here. This is my place now. Odilmash name Darim. He says, we live together. Says, listen, I encumbered the lower part of the house to you, but not on the condition that you're going to throw me out. I said that if it doesn't work out upstairs, you can come live with me downstairs. But not that you're going to kick me out of my own house. Imtim Salomar, if you want to stay, Shneim Darimbo, that they live there together. Remember, for the Rambam, Imtim Salomar means the Gemara concluded. So here the Gemara is concluding that he only has a right to move downstairs with him. He doesn't have a right to kick out the landlord. Kishu Mishtamesh, Derech Pitachim Mishtamesh, Uderech Yagim Mishtamesh. This party who used to live upstairs, how does he enter and exit the house? The person downstairs enters and exits the house through the doorways, because that's what he had beforehand. The person who lived upstairs had a separate entrance. He had an aliyah, which had usually a porch around it, and the porch had stairs or a ladder down from it. So in the past, his entry and exit would be done through the upper part. So do we demand of him then to climb upstairs, even though there's nothing upstairs anymore, it's collapsed or mostly collapsed, but he can climb up. He can climb up, go to the porch, and descend. How does he exit the house? Does he exit the way that he used to exit, or can he exit in the same doorway that the Baal HaBayit exits from? Mi amar kivdimi ikara, can the landlord say him, exit the way you used to? Mami ikara derech gagin, just like before, he used to exit from that entrance upstairs, entrance and exit upstairs. Hashanami derech gagin. Udilma matzi amrele, or maybe the renter can say back to him, aliyah kabilei alai. Aliyah virida lo kabilei alai. When I went to live upstairs, I accepted the fact that I would have to climb up the stairs to get in there, and that I would have to descend from those stairs when I left. What I did not accept was the fact that I would have to, in order to enter my house, go upstairs and then descend. And to leave it, I have to up and down again. That's two pieces, meaning that I'm doubling the work I have to do to enter and exit my house. I didn't accept that. Again, imtim salomar, matzi amalei ali avriyada lo kabili alai. Again, for the Rambam, means that we just concluded that he can make that claim. That I did not accept the responsibility to go up and down, and therefore he can exit and enter the house through the doorways of the house. Shtei aliyot, zo agave zo, mahu. If you have a triplex, you have three units on top of each other. You have the base unit, and then two upper units that sit one on top of the other. So it's three floors. Ifrit elyona. If the upper one breaks down, nachit vidar betachtuna. Then he comes and lives in the lower one. That seems to make a lot of sense. If you're on the third floor and then the base collapses, you can move into the second floor. Because again, you're not losing any convenience over there. You're in a better situation than you were before, maybe except for the view and maybe the air, wind, or whatever it is. But generally, you're okay. So if the upper chamber breaks, he moves down into the second aliyah, which is the one below it. If chitachtona, what happens if the middle one, their floor breaks down? Mahu. What is the din, the mislak, the gamre beliona? Can he force him to go to the third floor? Mi amrina and damrele, shem aliyah kabalit alach. The landlord says, you agree to live upstairs. Upstairs can be on the second floor or the third floor. Odilma chad aliyah kabilale, shte aliyot, lo kabilale. When he said, I live upstairs, I accepted living on a second floor. I did not accept living on a third floor. Teiku, over there, they both have decent claims, which is the landlord says, you accepted upstairs. Upstairs can be a second or third floor. The person who's living there says, no, when I said upstairs, we agreed to a second floor, not a third floor, and I don't have to take up the additional walking upstairs. There's a teiku, it's an unresolved issue, as to whether the person in the middle section, if his floor collapses, can the Baal HaBayit, can the landlord push him to the upper, the third floor, or can he demand to stay downstairs with the Baal HaBayit, because he says, I don't want to walk up three flights of stairs to get to my house. So Tosfot over here asks, what exactly is the scenario here? It says, all he said to him is that on top of this house I'm giving it to you. And now we don't know. So if he specified which aliyah, then there's nothing to speak about. So now the question is, he says, aliyah agabe bayit zeh. So now, what is the definition of bayit? And that's the safek according to the Baal Tosafot. It's the definition of bayit, the entire building, and therefore he can force him to the third floor. So the definition of bayit, always the lowest floor, and therefore he can has a right to descend to the lower floor, and that's the teiku that the Gemara remains with. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Yud Zayin Amud Aleph.